You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freib.
Hello.
Well, listen, it feels like we're in the final countdown stages to a huge date in the cycling calendar. 1st of August is...
my birthday.
Yeah, I was oh, thanks for ruining that joke, Daniel. Strade Bianche, first World Tour race of the resume season. And, well, it's always a big date in the cycling calendar because it's Daniel's birthday, and it's a special one this year, isn't it, Daniel? It's a special one.
It's a big day because usually that's when we start to find out about riders moving teams. But of course, Israel Startup Nation lived up to their name. You know, started up a bit prematurely, didn't they? They announced their big signing about a week ago.
Definitely changing the subject. It is a big birthday, isn't it, for you this year? You'd be doing maybe a 40-kilometre bike ride or something to celebrate?
I'm not sure about that.
You're younger than Alejandro Valverde.
Yes.
Valverde, I think, turned 40 on the eve of what should have been Liège-Bastogne-Liège this year. But, of course, that's all turned on its head. And, well, we are looking ahead to the resumption of racing very soon, very imminently. This is the final podcast before big time racing does resume. The one that we're really looking forward to at the moment is Vuelta a Burgos next week. Normally a kind of a race that comes in a sort of lull in between.
Could you just point to Burgos on a map?
Yes.
I think so.
Is that because you've got the internet open, Rich? You don't agree. Napalm seems quite confident, but I don't think you are.
Well, it'd be easy to point to it on a map if the map had place names on it, of course. But no, Burgos is a little... tapping away.
It's in the north, in the middle.
Just beside the Basque country, isn't it?
Kind of northwest-ish. Just above the bread basket.
Does it not neighbour the Basque country, Daniel?
Yes, it does, yeah. Rich. Yes, it does. So south of the Basque country.
What I was actually calling up was, can you name a couple of the recent winners of the Vuelta a Burgos?
Ivan Sosa.
He won the last two editions.
Nairoman
won in 2013 and 14, yes. Also Mikel Landa, Alberto Contador in recent years.
Usually the winner of the Vuelta a Burgos is the guy who wins the last stage to Lagunas de Nela, which is the big summit finish there. Very beautiful part of Burgos, if anyone gets the opportunity to go.
There's going to be a lot more interest in whoever wins this year's race, isn't there? Because it's a real test of, I guess, who has come out the last few months well, who's trained well. And in this episode, we're going to be each, I think, picking something that we're looking forward to or most intrigued about as racing does resume. Couple of little announcements from us before we get into the news roundup. The first is that our long-awaited cycling podcast jerseys made by Katusha are now available, and anyone who's registered an interest in that will get an email at the end of this week. But it is available for sale in limited quantities at the moment, but more will be made. Have a look at that through our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. Go to shop, and it's just the cycling jerseys at the moment. The t-shirts are coming later on. Also, our good friend Stacey Snyder, the ceramicist who makes these beautiful mugs and cappuccino sets, she's made a limited run of Friends of the Cycling Podcast cups and cappuccino sets, and they are very nice indeed, and you can buy them from her at her Etsy page. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's a bit too complicated to read out, but you can find her on Etsy, and the run of all different patterns and colours, cups and cappuccino sets are available there in limited numbers. Lionel, do you have a news roundup for us, please?
I do indeed, Richard. Yes, first of all, well, this is something that you mentioned on the podcast last week, Richard. Was it the week before? I can't remember now. But Team Ineos will be known as Ineos Grenadiers for the Tour de France. And they've got a new kit, a dark blue jersey, almost black jersey. But I think it is dark blue looking at the photographs. Yeah, a rebranding to Ineos Grenadiers. A soldiering overtone to that, isn't there? Grenadier Guards, and but it's after the Ineos Grenadier sort of Land Rover, the latest line in a sort of Land Rover, an off-road vehicle, isn't it? Which we talked
one
about.
That you're a big admirer of it, Lionel.
Yeah, well, I made my comments on that a couple of weeks ago. I mean, it's an odd one for me, but there we are. That's what it is. There will be the Ineos Grenadiers, and I'm looking forward to maybe seeing some big fluffy helmets, a bit like the soldiers. No,
I don't think they'll be wearing fluffy helmets.
No. It makes me think of grenadine sort of squash. Well, the syrup that kids in France drink. You're frowning at me, napalm. When we used to go on holiday to France, we used to buy the syrup, which was, you know, the French equivalent of squash, which you dilute with water, and pomegranate, which is grenadine in French. We're probably the most popular flavour.
They used to come in a sort of metal tin, didn't
they? Still
they
do.
And the lid's right in the centre, so the syrup spills around the top and it gets all sticky and attracts flies, flies and wasps,
yes.
Is what I remember from camping holidays.
I'm very fond of the mint flavour, and I often order that, and people are usually absolutely disgusted because it looks like mouthwash.
Just returning
and
to,
tastes like mouthwash.
Returning to the fluffy helmets suggestion, somebody, an aerodynamicist, apparently told me a few years ago that he reckoned hairy legs were actually more aerodynamic than shaved legs because the hair creates a pocket of air. And if that were true, you would think that Team Ineos would have developed hairy helmets by now or hairy skin suits. But thankfully, that hasn't happened yet.
Teddy bear outfits. Anyway.
Horrible.
Should we get on with this? I mean, it's been a long old run without some cycling to talk about. I think we've done pretty well, but...
I think we're just reaching the end, scraping the barrel here.
There was some virtual indoor pretend racing in the virtual Tour de France. The Chalet Reynard stage on pretend Mont Ventoux was won by Mike Woods ahead of Domenico Pozzovivo and Louis Menkes. The women's stage was won by Ashley Moulman-Passio. And then they finished on the virtual Champs-Élysées. Will Clark of Trek Segafredo beat Filippo Ganna of Team Ineos, and Lauren Stevens of Team Tibco Silicon Valley won the women's race. Team Tibco also won the overall GC, and the men's overall GC was won by NTT Pro Cycling. They took it very seriously, didn't they, Daniel? NTT.
Apparently so, Napalm. Yeah, I don't know if you saw the pictures. There was a big battery of backroom staff egging them on. Standing around the turbo trainers cheering. Bjarne Riis was there getting very animated. You see that?
Really? Really?
Yes. Yes.
Well, you take what you can get when there's been no actual outdoor road racing since the spring. There's some transfer news that's been in L'Équipe the last day or so. Rumours that Romain Bardet and Pierre Latour will both be leaving AG2R at the end of the season. It looks very much like Total Direct Energy have already agreed to some kind of deal with Latour, but they may also be interested in Bardet, who has been linked with Team Sunweb. That would leave quite a hole in AG2R's lineup, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would, Napalm. They would have to have a complete rethink, I would suggest, because there's not that much else in their roster, certainly for stage races. And they've got Oliver Narsen, who's been an excellent classics rider over the last few years, but it's a team really whose sort of soul, whose history, whose heritage is all about stage racing and riding well and aggressively in the mountains. They're a team which is based in the Alps in Chambéry. So you would think that they would be on the lookout for a climber or multiple climbers, and French climbers if possible, but there aren't too many of them around. They've got a very promising young one, Mr. Champoussin. I can't really think where they will turn their attention. They'll probably have to go foreign. Quite a number of good climbers in other teams, other nationalities who are out of contract.
Well, speaking of Bardet, we were all quite looking forward to him turning his hand to the Giro d'Italia this year, weren't we? But it now looks certain that he'll do the Tour de France instead. Richard, you mentioned the return of the racing, the first World Tour race being Strada Bianca on August 1st. Just before that, the Vuelta a Burgos in Spain. But Also, starting tomorrow, there's a Sibiu Tour in Romania, which Alpecin Fenix, Androni and Gazprom have all pulled out of, apparently because of a spike in coronavirus cases. Bora Hansgrohe and Israel Startup Nation are still on the start sheet there, but I suppose that's the first, well, it's the first UCI 2.1 race that's returning, I believe, but really the kind of the Grand Tour and Classics riders will return en masse at the Vuelta a Burgos next week. I talked a couple of weeks ago about the clash between the last stage of the Tour de France and the World Time Trial Championship, and Switzerland's Stephen King, who is set to be a key domestique for Thibaut Pinot at the Tour de France for Groupama FDJ, has already confirmed that he intends to leave the Tour de France early, if selected, as he expects, in order to ride the World Championships on home soil in Switzerland. Remember, he took a bronze medal in the road race in Yorkshire last year, will fancy his chances of doing well in the time trial. There's been a story knocking around that the organisers of this year's World Championships, which are due to take place right at the end of the Tour de France and running into that gap, the weekend between the end of the Tour and the beginning of the Giro, in this kind of crazy crammed calendar that we've got for the last 2.5 months of the season. The Worlds are due to be held in Switzerland, of course, but if anything were to happen and the event had to be cancelled or postponed, there's been a suggestion that it could be held next April after Liège-Bastogne-Liège, with the 2021 World Championships being held in Flanders as planned next September. So we could go from no World Championship this year to having two in 2021, one of which would be the 2020 race. But I mean, that is all highly speculative at the moment. What we do know is that at the Tour of Poland, which starts on August the 5th, there will be no media or fans on the race. And we are, well, we're waiting to find out what our working conditions will be at the Tour de France, aren't we? Daniel, you'll be working for ITV, of course. So we assume you'll be there with a microphone on a 2 meter stick. Richard and I are waiting to find out whether there will be any access for the likes of us. But, well, we're poised, aren't we, Richard? Ready to do whatever we can to cover the tour.
Hotels are booked, Lionel, and engine is revving, virtually.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to our title sponsor, iWalker. I'm very grateful to them for their support. And iWalker have had great news. They've been able to open up applications now for the CBILS, that's a coronavirus business interruption loan scheme. So you don't just register your interest now, you can actually apply for a loan, which is a big step forward. Also from next week, they'll be able to offer their Flexi Loan again. That's their normal product, a flexible loan of up to £200,000 designed to make short-term investments and manage cash flow. They've seen demand for the Flexi Loan coming back among small businesses that either weren't impacted by COVID or those who got back on their feet using a bounce back loan from the government. So that's good news as well. Things return to some kind of normality for a lot of the small businesses that iWalker support. And if you are, or you run, or you're involved with a small business, check out iwalker.co.uk and see the information that they have there to support you and offer you advice and help, and also these loans are now available. Now, we mentioned that racing's about to resume, and we each have picked something or things that we're most intrigued by or looking forward to. Daniel, what is it about this period that's coming up of a lot of racing that, well, what's the thing that you're kind of curious to see?
Well, chaps, I'm sure you noted that at the weekend the much trumpeted, hotly anticipated charter flight carrying all of the, well, the top Colombian riders did touch down in Europe. So there'd been some doubts about whether the Colombians would be able to get back and start their seasons, but they did. I think most of the top Colombians were on that plane. Certainly Superman was on it. I expected Superman to be flying over the Atlantic.
What's he doing getting in a plane?
With his cape fluttering behind him, but I think he was on there. And various others as well, and then they touched down. Egan Bernal was on there. and they then touched down in Madrid, I think, and dispersed to their various homes and where they're going to be training the next couple of weeks. One rider who was certainly on there as well was Nairo Quintana, and he was, well, he was the star really of the pre-lockdown season, wasn't he? Up until Paris-Nice, which was his last race. Well, he actually, I mean, we did a podcast during the Giro on Max Schachmann, who won Paris-Nice overall and sort of called him the last race winner. But the last guy to sort of cross a line, raise his arms, salute a victory before the lockdown in a World Tour race at least, was Quintana. So he won there. He'd also won at Chalet Reynard in the Tour of Provence earlier in the season, and he looked rejuvenated, didn't he? It looked to be a sort of return to the Quintana of the, well, his early career really, so 2013-14-15, when most of us expected him to win a Tour de France. He won the Giro, and then in 2016 he won the Vuelta, didn't he? But in the last 3 years he's certainly struggled and has seemed to be, dare I say it, Rich, a bit of a fading force. His deficit from Ineos in particular, the Ineos riders Froome and Thomas and last year Bernal, has grown really with every season. There's been a change this year in the sense that he's gone to a new team, so he's at the French team Arkea Samsic, and that seemed like an unusual choice, or a lot of people thought it was an unusual choice when he decided to leave Movistar after all those years and go to a smaller team on the face of it. But it did seem to give him wings earlier this year, and he seemed to have got a lot of enthusiasm back. He seemed to feel wanted again, and really that was reflected in the way he was riding. He did seem to have a lot more zip in his legs, and just to be someone who was sort of happy in his own skin again. But is that going to continue? There were other riders at the start of the season already suggesting that he was going to be a major threat for the Tour, one of the favourites, that he was climbing better than anyone else in the peloton. The question is, has the bar risen, since 2013-14-15, when he was someone who could have won the Tour? Hasn't finished on the podium of a Grand Tour since 2017. So I'm just really intrigued to see where he fits in this, what we think is going to be a bit of a rejigged hierarchy, a sort of a semi-new world order after this lockdown, with different training loads, different time of year for the Tour de France. There won't be the same issues with, if anyone had issues with allergies before, they'll be different in late August. So there'll be a lot that's different about this year's Tour de France, as well as Quintana's different circumstances.
And I think we learned a bit more about Quintana and his previous environment and his happiness there in just after lockdown commenced with the Movistar series, which was really, really fascinating insight into how they operated with their three leaders, Valverde, Landa and Quintana. And it was clear that it seemed that Quintana wasn't particularly happy there, and they weren't particularly happy with him. There were real communication problems, it seemed. And he gave the speech when it came to leaving the team, where he sort of apologised for not having been the most communicative at times and hard to read. That sort of added a whole kind of new bit of context to what we witnessed just in these early weeks of this season, where he had looked rejuvenated and the body language was very different, and the way he was riding was different. I always remember you saying, Daniel, that in one stage of the Vuelta where there was quite a lot of pressure and expectation on Quintana, I remember Quintana and Valverde were still, it was 2018 actually, they were still kind of in contention to win the race when we got to Andorra. Simon Yates did eventually win outright, but Quintana attacked, you said, like a burst football. And a lot of his attacks in Movistar colours were like a burst football. And when we watched him attack on the lower slopes of Mont Ventoux, there was zip, there was exuberance, there was joy, it seemed, looking from the outside, that certainly hadn't been there in the last couple of years at Movistar. So yeah, he did look reborn, and it'll be fascinating to see how that continues or not for him as the racing starts again. And we'll get an early glimpse of Quintana because he's down on the start sheet for Burgos.
He is, and then he's going to ride the Mont Ventoux Denivelle Challenge, which will take him further up Mont Ventoux than the Tour de Provence did earlier on in the season. One factor for the riders who are focusing on the Tour is that they've got relatively little racing opportunity before they have to line up in Nice, haven't they? I mean, maybe a stage race, a Burgos Dauphiné Tour, and that's it. So there's not going to be a great deal of opportunity to, you know, if any rider, whether it be Quintana or anyone else, thinks they're a little bit behind where they want to be, there's not an awful lot of time to catch up, is there? It's going to be, as you said, Richard, at the start, a real test of how people respond when that the intensity of racing against other people takes over from the more controlled environment of training. Whether, you know, they may well have been training like absolute demons, but it's not the same as pinning on a number and racing against other people and not being able to just set your own pace. So I suppose it's a bit like the Tour de France in a normal year kicking off in what, late March or early April. It will be really unusual to see, but we'll get a few little clues, won't we? Certainly that's what makes the Vuelta a Burgos a really interesting one to keep an eye on next week.
Yeah, I would expect Quintana to perform really well, particularly on that stage to Lagunas de Nela and the other mountain stage to Pico en Blanco. But just a couple more things, chaps, on Quintana, just that have come to me now. I mean, I think I said at Paris-Nice that the sense that I got just watching him interact with his team was this sort of reciprocal flattery, that he has been flattered by the reception that he's got from RKS Amsic, that, you know, he does feel wanted again. He feels honoured almost to be with the way that they have treated him and the way they've opened their arms to him. And they, in turn, kind of feel flattered that, you know, someone of his stature, and also, you know, a Colombian rider. Colombian riders are not necessarily, you know, well-renowned for their ability to, or they haven't been in the past, they've tended to stay in Spanish-speaking teams. I mean, he's trying hard to learn a bit of French, and he's trying to be the perfect guest as well. So I thought that, as I said, had really given him a kind of new or a different demeanour in the spring. I'm intrigued to see the effect of spending so much time at altitude for some of these Colombian riders. I mean, we've seen it creep up year after year after year. Riders are spending more and more time at altitude, but really we've got a situation this year where some riders have mainly been at altitude for the whole season. And that's going to be intriguing. And also just the Tour de France route. You know, there's no flat time trial. There's one time trial and it's a mountaintop finish, and it's very steep on it's on the penultimate day. So someone like Quintana will never have a better opportunity to win the Tour de France again, I don't think.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks as ever to Science in Sport, our longest standing supporter. They've been backing us at the Cycling Podcast since 2016. And we've been mentioning in the last few weeks their new range, the Turbo Plus range, which is designed to help with indoor training in particular, but also training in warm weather. It's got menthol in it. And I did try it today on my bike ride in the French heat here. Tried a menthol gel. Quite strange. I wondered whether it would taste like toothpaste. I'm glad to report it doesn't. It's more menthol than mint, if you know what I mean. It's not quite as minty as I expected.
Don't really know what you mean, no.
No, well, that menthol, James Morton last week explained that the cooling effect, and it really lingers and it does cool you down. It has been very hot here, so I enjoyed my menthol Science and Sport gel. Let's hear from James Morton again. He's Director of Performance Solutions at Science and Sport, renowned nutritionist, and he's also asked for your questions, remember, so do email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com if you've got a question for James. But let's hear from him again now.
People assume because the session is shorter that you don't need as much fuel, but of course when you're riding harder, then energy expenditure goes up and the amount of carbohydrate that you burn as a fuel during exercise goes up. But consuming carbohydrate during exercise, even in those shorter sessions, is also important because of what it can do for the brain. There was many studies in the literature where carbohydrate was improving performance even though the exercise duration was less than 60 minutes. Now, in those types of sessions, your body shouldn't run out of carbohydrate stores, so it was quite surprising that actually feeding carbohydrate could still improve performance. And what the researchers also did around that time was they actually infused glucose into the bloodstream rather than actually feeding the carbohydrate. And when they fed glucose through the bloodstream, they didn't see a performance benefit. So then they hypothesized, well, there must be something about consuming the carbohydrate, perhaps improving performance through non-metabolic mechanisms. So they did a whole series of elegant studies which proved that rinsing carbohydrate in the mouth for 10 seconds before you swallowed can actually activate regions in the brain. And those regions are associated with reward and motor control and motivation. And so then there was a whole explosion of studies all consistently showing, all from independent labs, that rinsing carbohydrate around the mouth is actually ergogenic to performance. And it does that through a central mechanism. So a standard carbohydrate drink, of course, what we normally do is we swallow it as fast as we can. But probably what we should be doing is rinsing it in our mouth for around 10 seconds and then swallowing it.
So that was James Morton, Director of Performance Solutions at Science and Sport. And fascinating findings from a study that's found that there can be performance benefits from just rinsing a carbohydrate drink in your mouth without even swallowing it. Did you know that, Daniel?
This reminds me of something that HTC Columbia tried a few years ago. They had some kind of gum shield or something that looked like a gum shield with something, some sort of syrup on the inside or something that tasted sweet, which was basically designed to have the same effect, to trick the brain. Possibly, I mean, as you can probably tell, I don't know an awful lot about this subject, but this was being employed in time trials, and it was to trick the brain into thinking that I think it had more, there was more glucose available to the body than was actually the case. I don't know whether that's something that people are still using.
It's real, you know, according to what James says, it does activate regions in the brain associated with rewards, motor control, and motivation, so that the benefits are perceived but also real according to these studies.
Daniel, do you achieve the same effect with your French syrup, just not diluting it, just having it neat, a little shot of it?
No, I don't, Napalm, but I am looking forward to the day when we see riders doing time trials with chopper chips. Chopper chips? Chopper chups?
Well, just
sticking
just
out of their mouths.
On Science and Sport, do remember you can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products, including the new Turbo Plus range, at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. And a little bit later on, I'm going to tell you a little bit about something else Science and Sport are involved with and helping to promote. But for the second thing that one of us is looking forward to, I mean, it's a subject we've talked about the last 2 weeks, but it's difficult to avoid the intrigue at Ineos Grenadiers, is that right? Or Ineos Grenadiers, as they will be known for the Tour de France. You know, the big intrigue is whether Chris Froome will be picked. You mentioned he's joined Israel Startup Nation, apparently on a 5-year contract. Is that correct, or is that a rumour?
I've heard that on the grapevine, Rich, that it's a very long-term contract. We don't know whether he intends to ride all 5 years. That would take him to the age of 40, I think, would it not?
And that's a grand old age, isn't it, Daniel?
Well, it is. A bit more information is starting to trickle out about the Froome deal. I don't know about you, chaps, been lost few days. I've been able to glean a bit more. I think he was offered a deal by Ineos, that's what I've heard, but it was blown out of the water by a very lucrative offer from Israel Startup Nation and a very long contract.
That's interesting, because that's in contradiction to the Ineos statement that said
it's not, because I checked this.
Right.
Well, Rich, what the Ineos statement said, or what Dave Brailsford said in the Ineos statement, was we have taken the decision not to renew it. Is that the same as taking the decision not to offer him a deal? I don't think it is.
I was told by an Ineos source a few weeks ago that Froome would have been offered a contract very similar to the one that he's on had relations not deteriorated between him and the team over the last couple of months. And I think that dates back to Bernal's comments that he made about expecting to go to the Tour as sole leader, as the leader, and with a full team supporting him. That elicited a not great response from Chris Froome, or the Chris Froome camp, or people close to Chris Froome, and this scuppered any possibility of a similar contract to the one that he's currently on, which we believe to be worth about £4 million a year. So yeah, there could be some subtlety in that
your source could be better than my source.
Well, who knows? It is intriguing, and it's fascinating to, you know, to just wonder and speculate about whether A, Froome will go to the Tour, and B, what would happen if he does, you know, in a team with Egan Bernal and Geraint Thomas. And we're going to get not surprising, but interesting that both Bernal and Froome have been picked for the Route d'Occitanie, which starts, it's a four-day stage race, starts on the 1st of August, same day as Strade Bianche. A few names already confirmed for that race. It's a race that Quintana has done in the past. It's often been a kind of low-key pre-tour warm-up race. Thibaut Pinot is riding it. Superman is riding it this year for Astana as well. But the real interest is going to be in Ineos and what happens there, and whether that's a sort of early rehearsal for the Tour. We've got Bernal, Froome, and Pavel Sivakov, who, as you said, I think, last week, Daniel, could well be a kind of third card. He is developing nicely as a stage racer. He rode very well at the Giro last year, still very young indeed. And I speculated last week on the possible Tour team for Team Ineos. I had a question mark against Chris Froome. I also had a question mark against Theo Gegenhardt, although I had him on my long list. And I did hear from Theo Gegenhardt about that. He took issue with my question mark, didn't really elaborate on that. So I wonder if Theo Gegenhardt is in line for the Tour de France. He may well be, in which case, apologies for the question mark, but I was just guessing. But yeah, I mean, Bernal, Sivakov and Froome all riding that race together, that may just be a test to see how things work out there.
Sivakov would be a good leader for AG2R, wouldn't he?
He talked
about them needing someone potentially to replace Romain Bardet, someone who is he riding for France? Or no, he's riding for Russia these days, isn't he, Rich?
Well, he is riding for Russia.
Grew up in France, born in Italy.
I mean, he is, according to Pro Cycling Stats, out of contract at the end of the year. I would be very surprised if he's not, you know, been offered and signed a new contract with Team Ineos. He was very close to Nicolas Portal, of course, who very sadly died earlier this year. It was Portal that really lured him to Team Ineos. I spoke to him at the start of the year. He was qualifies for a French passport as well, but he had made some overtures to the French Federation and heard nothing back, he said, a year or so ago. So he was still racing on a Russian passport, and that was creating a bit of confusion this year with Russia, you know, banned from the Olympics, and he wasn't quite sure who he was going to, or, you know, how he was going to race the Olympics.
I think somebody had unplugged the French Federation's fax machine that day, so couldn't get through. I'm joking, of course. Just on the Bernal Froome Thomas triangle, they're likely to all line up together at the Dauphiné, aren't they, for what will be a truncated Dauphiné, only 5 days long this year, of course, because it's got to be squeezed in amongst everything else. But that will be the first opportunity to see what the sort of dynamic is. And Daniel, from a safe distance, you'll probably witness that, won't you? You can pick up on body language from a couple of meters away.
Yes, on the dynamic. I mean, we talked last week, didn't we, about small, practical at times things communicating possibly to the riders and to, you know, those of us on the outside, who really is the leader there, or who really does have preference. And wasn't there was a story, wasn't there, in the Tour de France, I think won by Geraint Thomas, about someone getting the air conditioning unit in their room, Froome rather than Thomas, or something along those lines. But, you know, all sorts of little things that are going to be difficult to sort of administer and be on top of, just to make sure that, you know, as the riders are saying publicly, it is the road who decides who is the leader there.
Surely Jim Ratcliffe has got deep enough pockets to book three rooms with air conditioning.
Air conditioning has been implicated by some studies in the spread of COVID-19, so I need to be careful on that.
A little personal message for me, but I've mentioned on the podcast before that I would have been doing Ride London this year to raise money for Pancreatic Cancer UK. My mum died from pancreatic cancer 15 years ago, and so I know what a terrible disease it is. I also know how underfunded Pancreatic Cancer UK are, and how big a deal it was for them to be Charity of the Year at this year's Ride London. It would have provided really important funding. But with the event cancelled, that funding has gone. There is now an alternative. My Prudential Ride London will be the first virtual edition, and it will take place on the 15th and 16th of August to celebrate cycling and raise funds for charities. It's free to enter, and once you've entered, you ride 100 miles, 46 miles or 19 miles. Those are the sportive distances from Ride London, or indeed a distance of your choice. The organisers are encouraging riders to pick a charity and do the ride as a fundraiser. If you enter, you're eligible to enter a competition with prizes including a Brompton bike, a SRAM group set, a set of zip wheels and much more. Sign up at myridelondon.co.uk. That's myridelondon.co.uk. The event app, which will be downloadable in the week before the ride, will enable you to see the actual ride in virtual comparison to the Ride London course, and it'll generate finisher selfie pics and a personalised certificate as well. And if you're looking for a charity to support, do consider Pancreatic Cancer UK, who really have lost out through the cancellation of this year's event. When you sign up to My Ride London, just set up a Virgin Money giving page in support of Pancreatic Cancer UK. Well, we mentioned earlier Science and Sport, who support the Cycling Podcast, of course, and they were keen for us to mention something that they are supporting, and that is the Diversity in Cycling Report, which was written a couple of years ago by Andy Edwards. I had a long chat with Andy last night about the background to that. It's something we're going to return to. There are details in the show notes, but you can find the Diversity in Cycling report at the website diversityincycling.com and also on scienceandsport.com. It has an Instagram page as well, diversityincycling_. That's the Instagram account. I mean, Andy had noticed more riders from Black and Asian backgrounds on bikes and in Lycra, but not necessarily in cycling clubs. That was the catalyst for him writing this report, which originally, or at first, was just for his own club. He discussed the issue with his friend Manny Arthur, who is Black British, and that led to them collaborating to write the report. And it was aimed primarily at clubs, but the core themes that emerged apply to pretty much all aspects of cycling, including brands and the media. The report aims to help white people in cycling become more racially aware and also to demystify the sport for newcomers and especially those from Black and Asian backgrounds. The report is a grassroots project. It was produced independently with no budget. British Cycling supported its publication, but it did not commission it, pay for it, or influence its contents. Now Science and Sport and other brands are coming on board to help spread the word. I've read it, it's really interesting. There's a lot to take from it, in particular about clubs and, you know, how they welcome newcomers, all kinds of newcomers, but especially people from minority backgrounds. So as I say, more details in our show notes if you're interested to read the report, and we'll return to this subject again. It may well feature as our special friend special, because quite a lot of suggestions we've had from some of our friends of the podcast for a guest edited episode that we'll be working on a bit later are along this theme. Now Lionel, it's your turn to pick out something that you're looking forward to as racing resumes imminently.
Well, a slightly more general one than you two chaps. We've debated or discussed the wisdom of trying to hold all three Grand Tours between August the 29th and November the 8th, plus all of the Spring Classics, plus the World Championships, plus some other stage races, and whether that's actually going to be too much for the teams to cope with, especially after, you know, several months off. Well, on the one hand, riders will be well trained and race fresh. They won't be fatigued from the racing, but the teams have got a field, a lineup in all of these events, the logistics. I mean, just talking to Mitch Docker about his own logistics about getting back into racing and being basically on standby just in case something happens to one of the riders in one of the other groups to him. You know, he's doing a kind of classics program, but you know, all the riders will potentially be forced to change those plans, other than the kind of the, you know, people who are specifically going for the Tour de France and maybe one or two other objectives. But what I like about certain aspects of the calendar, I really like the way it kicks off the three weekends with the Italian classics, Strada Bianca, then Milan-San Remo, then Il Lombardia. We go from spring to autumn in the space of 8 days in the height of summer. And it's going to alter the character of those races. It's going to change, potentially change who is in the mix to win them. And one of the things that I always enjoy is not knowing how something's going to play out before you start watching it. And really, we're all going to be in the same boat, aren't we? There's going to be a lot of guesswork based on very little evidence. There's not going to be any race form to go on. And we won't know for sure, you know, somebody lining up at Milan-San Remo, whether they're there to try and win the race or whether they've got an objective a little bit later on, or specifically what their goals are going to be. And I think that from the point of view of the armchair spectator, it's going to be a fantastic, September, October, November, a fantastic 3 months of racing where there's something of an elite level every weekend. And then from that period where the Giro runs into the Vuelta and there's the Spring Classics being run in a really unconventional way through the autumn, with the Hilly Classics first and then the Cobbled Classics to finish off the season, and the level of top racing to watch, the amount of top racing to watch is unprecedented. And the other thing about it, Daniel, this is something you always talk about when we talk about the World Championships and how the unknown often shapes the race in a way that you can't predict. I think the same will be true here, because there won't be any imperative to sort of put in place a plan that can then be replicated in subsequent years, because even if there were to be subsequent interruptions because of coronavirus, this particular calendar will probably not see the light of day again. And so there'll not only be no benchmark going into the races, they'll also be stripped down to the on-the-day objective, rather than sort of everything being a stepping stone to the next thing and the next thing. And perhaps, from my point of view, that will enable us to enjoy the races very much as a standalone thing. We enjoy the Tour of Flanders, and yes, we look forward to Paris-Roubaix, but it's the end of the season after that. There's nothing to come. So it's going to be very interesting, very unusual. I'm kind of looking forward to spotting the patterns as the weeks unfold and see how it all plays out.
I think as well, it's going to be one of the questions for riders who perform well is going to be, well, what did you do? You know, how did you spend your, you know, extended kind of period off racing? Is there going to be a trend for, because some riders were locked in their homes for 6 or 7 weeks, others weren't. You know, there's kind of contrast in the conditions that some riders work in. Some riders will have spent a lot of time on the turbo trainer, others won't. I spoke to one of the coaches at Team Sunweb a couple of weeks ago, Hans Timmermans. He said that their team had very few riders locked in their homes. Most of the riders could get out on the road training, but they spent a lot of time, put a lot of emphasis on learning and on practical skills, and they had sprinters studying sprint finishes, learning about what their rivals did, and they were sort of testing them on that. They had group sessions where, you know, certain riders were encouraged to motivate the team. They had scenarios where they were imagining planning for a particular race with different scenarios. They had track stand competitions. One of their female riders managed a 34-minute track stand. They had to send in videos of them doing track stands. So, you know, all kinds of quirky things. I'm not sure that'll be the difference between winning and losing, but it will be fascinating. One of the fascinating questions will be, what did you do? You know, how did you spend that time? What did you do anything differently? That will be an interesting thing to note.
I think if you do a 34-minute track stand in any of these races, you probably won't win. That much I do know.
I think, chaps, it will all feel very frantic. It will feel, well, to us, as though the season is on fast forward, which of course it is. It's been compressed and compacted into 3 months. And I just imagine some riders in particular feeling as though each individual race, there's a sort of a frantic nature and a panicked feel to the actual racing itself. I think everyone's going to be, they'll have had to time their form peak for now, basically, or for the next few weeks. And, you know, we hear often that the difference between the Tour de France and every other race in the calendar is that the Tour is the race where everyone at the start is in top form. And you know, the next 3 months are going to feel like that. Everyone is going to have built towards this moment. There's no question of you know, using a race or using a fortnight or a month to build into their best form. They're going to have to hit the ground running. And I imagine there are going to be some riders for whom it's going to feel quite traumatic, and riders who are maybe in the last year of their contract need to prove themselves, maybe hoping that they might get a day or a race where they'll be able to show what they can do, but that might not be the case for some of them. There aren't many opportunities there, and teams are not going to be able to take risks and give opportunities to guys who they don't have that much faith in. The sponsors need to be sort of repaid for their commitment and their loyalty in this very difficult time for everyone, and there are going to be some losers in all of this, some big losers I think among the riders.
But the pressure will, it's all very well to say, well, we've had no racing and therefore everything's a bonus, but there will be pressure to get results straight away. With everything compacted into 13 weeks, if a team takes 3 weeks before they register a race win, suddenly there's only 9 or 10 weeks left in which to make a mark. And it's going to, I would imagine, it could mean that not only is it an intense period of time, but it might add some extra intensity to the racing, and perhaps to the lesser races, that something like the Tour of Poland, which ordinarily would in recent years kind of overlap with the Tour de France, so it's not really had much of a spotlight on it, but this year it's a short week-long race, and stage victories there even will be at an absolute premium.
Well, there's much to look forward to, isn't there? And not just Daniel's birthday. I'm amazed you guys haven't asked me yet how the move went, how I'm settling into life in rural France.
I'm just astonished that someone who a few months ago, amid great fanfare, declared that he was going vegetarian, a few months later has performed the most emphatic vault fast ever seen and moved to France.
Vegetarianism has gone out the fenêtre, Daniel. It's gone out the fenêtre. Clearly. It's that's going to be a challenge. But I have to say, we've got a huge vegetable garden in the new house, so I don't know what all of them are yet. I'm just figuring that out.
Do you have to wear the onions as you are now, or
actually, what's that?
They go well with a beret.
What's that? What's that you're wearing on your head?
I've just got a cycling cap on.
Cool. Anyway, listen, well, we've just released the fourth part of our mini-series, My First Tour de France. It's your first Tour de France that you covered in full, Lionel. It's for friends of the podcast. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com if you want to listen to those and lots else besides. The latest episode includes some diary entries from Lionel Burney. He's a little bit more than, 14 and a quarter or whatever. I can't remember how old Adrian Mole was. But anyway, it includes your diary entries from the 2006 tour. Let's hear from one of them now. no wonder you're wincing, but it's very funny. It concerns a hard-hitting encounter with Christian Knees, where you really put him on the spot.
The thing is, Richard, I had hoped to preserve this type of quality material for friends of the podcast, but I suppose if we want to entice a few more people to sign up, this is the sort of Woodward and Bernstein type journalism that you can expect. Saturday, July the 8th, Stage 7, Saint-Grégoire to Rennes, 52-kilometre individual time trial. Stage winner, Sergei Honchar, yellow jersey, Sergei Honchar. One of the editor's brainwaves is to do a little light-hearted column in the magazine titled Cheese of the Week. Our protests are waved away because the idea of us having to fill this slot every week is too amusing to him. It's the sort of assignment everyone dreads, and so we felt the fairest thing to do was share it among ourselves and brainstorm some ideas. The tour spans four editions of the magazine, so four Cheese of the Week slots have to be filled. The Combativity Prize is sponsored by a Camembert producer, Cœur de Lion, so the first idea was to interview the winner of the Most Aggressive Rider Prize one day. The race director, Jean-Marie Leblanc, is retiring at the end of this year's tour after 18 years at the helm. Au revoir to the big cheese, Le Grand Fromage. That makes two. Today we tick off the third slot. We head to one of the team hotels on the outskirts of Rennes after the stage and wait for the riders to arrive after the time trial. We spot Christian Knees, who rides for the German Milram team, as he wanders through reception. Milram is a German dairy company. This is our chance. I nudge Ed. Go on. No, you go on, he says. We decide to share the embarrassment and approach Knees together. We explain our ludicrous assignment to him, and with every word his expression falls flatter and his eyes lose a bit more sparkle. No one is going to come out of this well. We all know this. I can almost see my own desperation reflected in Christian Knees's eyes. Pathetically, I offer Knees a triangle of brie we'd brought with us. Can we just photograph you with this piece of cheese, Christian? The second half of the sentence, and you'll never see or hear from us ever again, I promise, need not be said. Dutifully, like the good professional he is, Knees takes the brie, I take the photo, and our dignity takes a collective plunge. Ed and I are in the middle of congratulating ourselves for ticking this task off the list as we watch Knees head towards the lift. He makes it about halfway before slowing, then stopping, then turning round to walk back towards us. Oh no, he's had second thoughts about this. He explains that his team is sponsored by a dairy that produces its own cheese, and so it might not be a good idea to be photographed with a rival brand. Wait a moment, he says, I'll be right back. A couple of minutes later, Knees returns carrying a huge block of white, flavourless looking shrink-wrapped cheese. It must weigh 10 or maybe 15 kilograms. He poses for a second equally awkward photo and says, use that instead. Knees walks off. Ed and I look at each other and smile. The caption will write itself. Christian Knees and his enormous cheese.
Well, Lionel, they're giving Christian Knees an experience that he probably won't remember. But
journalistic self-immolation. more fondue. Fondue. Melted his own journalistic credibility with that.
Early indications are that listeners have been enjoying the series, and particularly my I mean, I've been pretty honest about what I had to get up to in those days.
I did enjoy Daniel's suggestion that you give the writers all party bags as they rode away from the Champs-Élysées at the end of that tour. But anyway, just before we go, quick reminder of what I said at the start, the clothing, cycling podcast clothing made by Katusha, the cycling jerseys, they're really beautiful designs and they look very nice. Looking forward to receiving mine. They're now available. Go to the Cycling Podcast shop. And also, you also should be able to link to this from the Cycling Podcast shop. I think we'll set that up. Stacey Snyder's friend of the Cycling Podcast cups and cappuccino sets. Links to these things are in the show notes as well. Just before we go, some thank yous to friends of the podcast. These are among the people who've signed up to become a friend of the podcast. From me, a big thank you to Nathan Brennan, Christopher Troop, Mark Richardson, Henry Dowson, Tim Stainthorpe, and Luke Dankert.
And thank you from me to David Funk, Graham Dickens, Andy Whitehair, Elizabeth Cornthwaite, Jed Parton, and Zuko Nonzuba. I hope that's pronounced correctly. South African name, Nonzuba.
And from me to Joan Salves, Chad Marshall, James Hook, Joe Horobin, Nan McLeod, and Steve Thomas.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.